you very much. Thank you for having me. As Dr. Bluck indicated, I'm a genetic counselor here. Many people often don't know what that means. So genetic counselors, we are master's trained mid-level practitioners and work directly with patient care as it relates to hereditary risk for diseases. Obviously, being employed here at Roswell Park, we do specifically in cancer-associated risks. So what she had asked me to do is, like she said, explain and kind of walk through a little bit, just review of inheritance patterns, but also kind of start bridging the gap a little bit from the science end of it to how we translate it into clinical patient care and information that we're providing not only to the patients but to their providers to help with medical decision-making as well. So like I said, we'll talk about risk assessment and kind of how we practice as genetic counselors, inheritance patterns, and then we're going to talk a little bit about genetic testing and how that is used in a clinical setting. So genetic counseling essentially is a process. So when we meet with patients, it is typically a time intensive process. A new patient appointment can last 60 to 90 minutes. Prior to meeting with them, we collect family history information and extensively kind of go through medical histories. For the patients and their family medical history, and based on that, we're able to really give a risk assessment as to what is the likelihood there's anything genetic associated with the disease in the family, and if so, what genetic condition or syndrome may we be dealing with to help guide some of our decisions about genetic testing. And so as we meet with the patients, usually our initial thing is to walk through their family history, clarify situations, and then provide them the assessment to say, okay, this is what it looks like is happening. If we were to test and confirm any of these diagnoses in you or your relatives, here's what the risks would be in terms of certain diagnoses. Here's what the medical management options may be to kind of deal with this. And then we talk about genetic testing and the option for them to pursue confirmatory testing to really identify whether this is truly what's going on for them and their relatives. And along with that, obviously, there's often a lot of different ethical, psychosocial, economic issues that we have to address as well. So I mentioned as genetic counselors, we are master's trained, so it's a two-year training program that we complete. There's only about 30 of them in the country right now, so it is still a pretty limited field. Our training really bridges the science of genetics with the kind of psychosocial, so a lot of times people ask me whether I'm a teacher, because when I am doing a session with a patient, it really is me simplifying genetics and complicated healthcare information to the family to make sure that they can have an understanding of it. So, you know, that is kind of where our training looks at both ends of it and understanding the emotional impact that some of this information can have on the family so that we can help them adjust with it and be able to communicate in their family about some of these risks. In terms of our training, we are trained generally as genetic counselors, but a lot of us work in subspecialties. So whether it's pediatrics, prenatal, cancer, a lot of times the jobs are very specific at this point instead of being a generalist. And it's typically just a lot easier and able to be focused because genetics has become such a broad field at this point. One of the big things about genetics that makes us very different from a physician seeing a patient is that we are seeing people a lot of times, especially in a cancer setting, in more of an elective standpoint. You know, whether they get this genetic information is their choice, regardless of whether the physician feels it's really important. Not every patient wants to know whether they have a genetic risk for cancer in them or their family. And our job is to really be the advocate for the patient in that regard and to try to provide them with enough information to make sure that they are making an informed decision as to whether this is information they want or not. You know, it's a little different than a patient showing up with a tumor that needs to be treated. Clearly, there's something that has to be done. Genetics is a little different in that regard. And so we very much try to respect that the patients have their autonomy in that regard and that make sure that we're giving them enough information so that they can make an informed decision. So we are very non-directive in that regard. So this is a pedigree. This is kind of our Bible in genetics in a clinical setting. This is how we collect family history information. And so in a very rough sense, basically what you're looking at, circles are women, squares are men. Usually if there is one of the symbols is filled in, that means there is a disease. And in our setting, that means there's been a cancer diagnosis in that individual. If there is a slash, which this example doesn't show any, but if there's a slash through a symbol, that would mean somebody is deceased. And then we had generational lines, and so this is how we really map out the family history. And so every patient we work with, we actually construct a pedigree for them, and it is really more for our essence, but we then give them a copy of it as well. And we're collecting information specific to what we are evaluating them for. So in a cancer setting, we're really collecting information about cancer diagnoses in the family. Whereas if somebody's working in a cardiac, genetics clinic, they're going to be looking at heart disease and that type of thing a little more specifically. One of the really important things, and that we're really trying to educate a lot of physicians and providers out there, is that family history is changing always. And so, you know, if we meet with a patient and collect family history, 2 years later, it could look very different. And so we can meet with patients who don't appear to need us or don't appear to have a hereditary risk for cancer today, and a few years from now, it could look very different. And so family history really needs to be updated on a very regular basis. And there's actually guidelines out there, to help indicate for physicians and for oncologists that this needs to be done on a regular basis. And not only do we need to know what type of cancer somebody had, we need to know what relationship they are to the patient. We need to know what age they were diagnosed with their cancer. Certainly the majority of cancers have no genetic component to them in terms of hereditary risk. And so our way of sorting that out is to have a better understanding of sometimes the specific pathology, the age at which things were presenting, and how closely related is that individual to the patient themselves as to whether there may be much impact on them. And so in that regard, also the other thing we're doing and trying to help further push is that we need to, if you meet with somebody in the breast clinic because they have breast cancer, we need to ask more about family history, not just about whether people in the family have had breast cancer. With a lot of these hereditary cancer syndromes, we see different combinations or clusters of cancer. So to ask, organ-specific questions could really be missing some of the picture. As well as sometimes there may be a patient with breast cancer whose family history is filled with tons of people with colon cancer, and we're actually worried about there being a hereditary risk related to the colon cancer. Irregardless of that person's breast cancer, that's still important information to have. And so when family history is being collected, it needs to be very broad-based and not asked. They need to do it not asking very targeted questions specific to the clinic that they're operating out of. And we need to, we always collect a three-generation pedigree. First, second, third degree relatives, your degree of relationship is how many steps away the person is from you. So, our children, siblings, and parents are all first degree relatives. They are one bump away from us. If you're going to grandparents, aunts, uncles, we're now second degree relatives. Cousins would be third degree relatives. These people are all very important to impacting risk for us, and so to just collect family history and first-degree relatives can very much be missing things, especially when we're talking about gender-specific cancer risks. So, ovarian cancer risk very well could be passing down through the paternal, through dad's side of the family. Well, you're not going to see it in a first-degree relative because he's a male. And so if we don't look further, we're going to miss things. The whole point of what we do in genetics and related to hereditary cancer risk is really to try to provide a better understanding of why diagnoses have happened, to try to better understand is there better ways to treat a current diagnosis for somebody, as well as what other risks might they have in the long term and how would that guide or impact screening and medical management. And so whether that is surgery approaches, screening, medications, and then beyond that and beyond the patient in front of us, what does it mean for the rest of their family? Who else is at risk? What are they at risk for? What do we need to be doing differently for them? This is all what we do. So although we meet with one patient, we really are kind of talking about broadly what the risks are for their whole family. With genetics also, we sometimes even with cancer genetics, this information can impact family planning and whether people are going to take different approaches to how that occurs for them as well. This information can sometimes be important. And then certainly with the growing field of personalized medicine and targeted treatments and therapies related to specific tumor lines, our genetic information kind of crosses over because, when tumor tissue testing is being done and something's identified, it is potentially not just the tumor, it is a hereditary risk potentially as well. And so we have to kind of translate that information out of specific that patient and into the rest of the family. So real quickly, this is kind of quick overview of genetics and the main things that are important from our perspective on a clinical end of things. Most importantly is to understand there are two main differences in genetic disease. And so whether we're talking about a chromosomal abnormality, which in general is not, from a hereditary cancer standpoint, something that we deal with, it certainly is something that comes up more tumor-specific, whether we're talking about translocations and whatnot. But from the standpoint of what I do daily and in a clinical setting, not dealing with chromosomal abnormalities, in a pediatric genetic setting, that's something very much that is dealt with. And so things like trisomy 21 and Turner syndrome, these are chromosomal abnormalities that are genetic, that are evaluated and diagnosed in people. One of the big things with chromosome abnormalities that come up often is also in a prenatal setting. We know what is called advanced maternal age, which is any woman who has a pregnancy at age 35 or older has an increased risk for chromosomal abnormalities. And so there are guidelines to indicate that certain testing should be offered to them because of this increased risk simply because of their age. And so chromosomal genetics is very much part of genetic counseling in other settings, not so much in the cancer field, though. So we deal very much with single gene disorders here, and looking at Mendelian inheritance and the impact that is having for certain diseases. And so there is a lot of common single gene disorders that are unknown and understood at this time. They're inherited in different manners. They can cause all kinds of different problems, but certainly we know that cancer risk is one of them in some of these settings. Primary form of inheritance. So there's three main ways that things can be inherited genetically. So autosomal dominant inheritance basically means that this is an alteration that is inherited equally by men and women within the family. If the mutation exists in an individual, there's a 50% chance for every child that they have that they may have inherited it as well. And so this is the majority of conditions that we work with in a hereditary cancer setting, is that these are things that are inherited in a dominant fashion. However, they don't necessarily express themselves in a dominant fashion, which means somebody who has a mutation in a hereditary cancer susceptibility gene is not guaranteed they're going to be diagnosed with cancer or ever develop cancer. So there's more of a recessive expression of the condition, although the genetics itself is inherited in a dominant fashion. And so mutations in the BRCA1 and BRCA2 gene are an example of this, certainly. And so like I mentioned, if somebody has a mutation, and again, gender does not matter here whatsoever, and that's where media has very much led everyone astray. Every time I meet with patients and we start talking about BRCA1 and 2, most everyone has heard about it. Media has run all over it, and they have very misrepresented what it is. Everyone assumes these are cancer genes and that only the women in the family are at risk for them. And so usually the very first thing we do is kind of set the stage and clear all of that up to say, this is very much something that men and women are both at risk for. Gender does not matter whatsoever, and so this can be coming from dad's side just as much as mom's side. And it's amazing and scary how many doctors are still out there in community settings that are misleading patients to say, oh, your aunt and your grandma had breast cancer, but that's on dad's side, it doesn't matter. And we are still trying to clear that up from time to time. So in a situation of looking at a pedigree, this is typically what you would expect to see. If there is a single gene condition running through a family with a dominant inheritance, would be that every child has a 50-50 chance. So as I explained to patients, you have four kids, we'd expect two are going to have it, two are not. But I also always explain to them, you flip a coin four times, you don't get two heads and two tails. And so anytime we're talking about testing that next generation, we always say, we don't know until we test somebody whether they're going to have it or not. It is a completely random event, whether things are passed on at the time of conception. So recessive inheritance is a little trickier from the standpoint of assessing for this clinically. It is a family history that is not as obvious. Typically, you're not going to see previous generations have been affected by the disease or condition, because generally what you're looking at is it's going to be one line of generation, one grouping of siblings that may suddenly present with us, and it's simply because it requires that there is a carrier parent that has that each of them are carrying this. And so you can see here, if mom and dad are both carriers and they have children, we know that there's a 25% risk with every pregnancy that the child will actually be affected, meaning they inherited both mutations. There's a greater chance that they are going to be carriers and that they may have inherited a single mutation. In many cases, therefore, is not going to cause disease presentation in them. This is something that, again, it just doesn't show up as easily in looking at a family history. So an example in a cancer genetic setting is a condition called Fanconi anemia. This is a condition that can be caused by mutations in over 15 different genes, but one of them is the BRCA2 gene, which is what we are dealing with very routinely for hereditary breast and ovarian cancer. And so anytime we identify somebody as having a BRCA2 mutation, if they are of childbearing age, we have a conversation with them about the potential risk for Fanconi anemia in their children, in addition to the cancer risk with BRCA2 being passed down singularly. Which is to say that if an individual's partner potentially has a BRCA2 mutation as well, there is this higher risk for a much more severe condition with Fanconi anemia, which will present in childhood with some very specific bone marrow failure, organ defects, that type of thing. When you look at a family history, it's not unusual that in a recessive condition, you may have just the one person who's affected. Everyone else may be carriers, or many of them, and carriers are not obvious to us by the naked eye. So, the final form of inheritance that can occur is X-linked inheritance. So this is related to genes and mutations on the X chromosome. Within X-linked inheritance, there can be recessive and dominant forms of X-linked inheritance. With recessive, obviously, again, you need two mutations, and so it is somewhat dependent on are we talking about it being a carrier female versus a male and what they're passing down. For females who have two X's, it's going to be a little different than the males who have one X and one Y and how this affects them. So an example of one of these conditions is hemophilia, which is a bleeding disorder. And typically it is primarily men who are affected by this because with the women, more often because you have to have two mutations, you have to have two X-linked mutations, it's not as common. Whereas with the men, because they only have one X chromosome, they only are going to have one mutation to be affected by it.
Isn't one X chromosome randomly
inactivated?
Yes, it is.
Yep.
So then why is that the case that you need
both to be mutated? Well, with recessive inheritance, you would need to have both.
Right. Okay.
It's recessive. Okay. Right. Nope. So fast forward here. This will answer, which is why there's an asterisk at the end of those lines. With dominant inheritance, you're right. With random X inactivation, which is what occurs, with females, we know that not both X's are actively engaged in being basically used. So you're right, with any dominant condition, it will depend on what X inactivation has occurred, which is kind of random. And that's why you can see a lot of variability in these conditions. Some people can be very severely affected just based on that randomness of X inactivation, and some may not present with really any symptoms at all. Interestingly, a lot of the X-linked conditions are not related to cancer risk or that regard. There was a study actually just published through some research done here at Roswell showing that there's good evidence for there being X-linked inheritance for ovarian cancer risk. So this is something that is pretty new. They haven't really targeted specifically the gene necessarily that they think is associated with it, but what they did was in using families that were in the familial ovarian cancer registry here at Roswell, they traced back and looked at all of the combinations of where there had been a grandmother and a granddaughter with ovarian cancer, and found that it happened much more commonly when it was a paternal grandmother, it was coming by way of dad, versus it having been a maternal grandmother. So it was statistically significant enough to support that the idea that this may be actually linked to something that is an X-linked gene that may be causing this. And so this would be kind of a big change to how we are working with families, and when we're talking about inheritance almost always being in a dominant fashion, this X-linked is a very different way of thinking about it. A few other kind of genetics terms that we use. We talk a lot about genotype versus phenotype, whether something, the genetic presentation of something versus the actual observed features. Pleiotropy is a term that basically indicates that there can be multiple traits associated with a single gene mutation, which is almost the case of every condition we work with. With one gene, we see lots of different combinations or clusters of cancer that can be presenting in these families. So we work with families that have breast and ovarian cancer associated. We work with families that have colon and uterine cancer clustering in the family. And so this is an example of pleiotropy. It's very rare that we identify a mutation and we say, you're at risk for this one thing. Rather, they are at risk for multiple organs affected. We also talk a lot about the expression of a mutation and kind of the degree of presentation. And so there's a condition that we work with in families called familial adenomatous polyposis. It is a colon polyp syndrome. And in its classic form, these people can develop hundreds to thousands of colon polyps, which is what this picture kind of shows. It's almost what they call carpet polyps. There are so many of them. We can't remove all of them quickly enough. And we know that polyps have the potential to become cancer, and if we don't get them out, these people will end up with a diagnosis. However, in the condition FAP, we can see much milder forms of it sometimes, what we call an attenuated form. And so that's somebody's colon on the right side who has attenuated FAP. They may have a single polyp. They may have only 10 polyps. And so they look very differently. And so how we manage them can be very different as well clinically, as in terms of how often they're being screened, whether we need to take surgical interventions. The problem being is that we don't always know, and that even within one family who has a condition like FAP, there can be one sibling who has excessive number of polyps, and there's another sibling who has much milder form, and we don't know often. Certainly we see a lot of situations where there can be the same phenotype. So I have a family history of breast cancer. Not everyone has the same cause to their breast cancer. And so we talk a lot about this as, you know, when I'm working with a family and there are five women who've had breast cancer, there may be a BRCA mutation present in four of them, and the fifth woman may not have it. And this kind of sometimes blows their minds to think, well, wait, why do I still have cancer if I don't have the cause? And we always have to remind them, you know, all of us have a risk for cancer. It doesn't go away just because there's a genetic factor in the family that is tied to the majority of diagnoses. Even if you don't have it, you still have a higher risk, or you don't have a higher risk, you have a risk, a general population risk. And so this is something that we always say, you know, having a negative genetic test result is not your get out of jail free card. We go back to general population screening recommendations for these people at that point. And so again, that's what phenotype, phenocopy, penetrance, like we said, none of these cancer syndromes indicate that somebody has 100% risk for cancer. And so we always are stressing that. Even when we identify somebody's having a hereditary risk, they have a higher risk and we're going to take care of them differently, but they may never have a diagnosis. So in regard to genetic testing, a lot of people walk in and say, well, isn't it just a blood draw? And our answer is typically yes. So that is very simple. But there are a whole lot of issues around genetic testing that make it much more complicated and why it is somewhat time consuming. So the first thing always is, well, who are we going to test? Just because the patient themselves was referred to us doesn't mean they're the best person in the family to be testing. The recommendation whenever possible in doing hereditary cancer genetic testing is to first test the people in the family who've had a diagnosis of cancer. And the reason for that simply is that if there is something genetic associated with why that diagnosis has occurred, most likely it's going to show up in those people. And that's going to provide us with the most informative understanding of the risks in that family. So it's not unusual that I will see people who've never had cancer who come in because their mother and their grandmother and their aunt all had cancer, and we would say, well, we could test you, but if we test you and the result's negative, we don't know what that means. Does it mean that mom had a genetic cause for her cancer and you just didn't inherit it? Yay, that's what we want to be able to know. Or does it mean we're testing for the wrong thing and maybe there's something else genetic that you could still be at risk for? We can't really interpret it as clearly. So whenever possible, we want to test the affected family members. If there's multiple of them, we want to test the one who was diagnosed at the youngest age because that is more suggestive of there being an underlying genetic risk to the cancer. Sometimes, though, there are families where there are no longer any living relatives. You know, everyone who's had the diagnoses have passed away, and at that point, then we certainly do test on affected people. We also always have the option of, are we pursuing clinical testing versus research testing? For the most part, at this point, we are doing almost all clinical testing for patients, and that is simply because genetic testing has evolved quite a bit in the last few years with next-generation sequencing and the technology changes that have occurred that really allow us to do very broad-based testing and have insurance coverage and actively be able to provide this to patients. In the past, that was not the case. We were often very limited in what was available, what we could get covered by insurance, and so we often were enrolling people into research studies to allow for broader testing or more comprehensive testing. Research obviously is still very important, and so there are situations where, in addition to the clinical testing, we are kind of sandwiching it with a research study as well. There's a lot of different ways and methodology to the genetic testing also. And so whether we're doing biochemical analysis, cytogenetics, again, majority of what we are often doing is molecular testing and looking for specific mutations within a gene, a specific gene. But even within that, it's kind of, well, what's the extent of testing? Are we doing a site-specific analysis because we already know the very specific mutation in that family? In that case, we can be very directive in what we're doing. With some of the genes, there's more targeted testing in the sense that there's only been mutations ever identified in a certain number of exons, and so instead of doing full gene analysis, they're doing more exon-specific analysis. Versus full gene, and then again, with the technologies, we're doing a lot of panel testing where we do multi-gene testing all at one time, and instead of really kind of shoring down and testing for one specific condition to find it's negative, therefore to bring the patient back and do another test, we're taking a more broad-scaled approach to things at this time and doing a lot of multi-gene testing. There's also the technologies that are doing exome and genome testing. This hasn't evolved into a cancer setting much at this point. There's not a lot of value that has been found necessarily in doing that big of a test. It is something that is being used very broadly in a pediatric setting with newborns who have birth defects, and we're really trying to identify what's going on here. Exomes and genome testing is something that is being used quite a bit. I mentioned a little bit about tumor tissue testing, so there's a lot of somatic tumor tissue testing being done here at Roswell now on diagnosed patients to help with treatment decisions and targeted therapies. We are not involved with that up front, so that is something that the oncologists are typically ordering for patients, but it is something that we get pulled into, and we're trying to bridge that a little better because a lot of patients aren't really understanding what this testing is and how our testing is different from the testing that their oncologist already ordered. And so it is an educational process for them to understand that the genetics of your tumor don't necessarily represent your peripheral genetics and what your family might be at risk for, or they may, and where the crossover occurs. The other thing we know is that, you know, you would assume if somebody has a germline mutation, so a hereditary risk, if they test a tumor, you would expect it'll show up in that tumor. The opposite may not hold true. But what we know is that sometimes the tumor tissue doesn't show the germline mutation, and there's a couple of reasons for that, and it's dependent on what laboratory was doing and what their platform and technology were. So some of the somatic tumor tissue testing doesn't look at all of the genes that we would look for, and so they're not going to find it because they're not even looking at it. We also know that there's just a lot of mutations present in tumors, and sometimes something that was actually a hereditary mutation could be masked or even corrected in the presence of the tumor itself, and so we're not going to always see it. So even somebody who's had a somatic tumor tissue test that appears normal does not mean they don't need hereditary or germline testing to evaluate for further risk in their family. The other thing we deal with is, what is the sample source? So again, a lot of people say, isn't it just a blood draw? Typically, yes. Genetic testing can also be done on saliva or buccal swabs. There's a lot of community providers who are doing genetics who will use saliva just because it's a simpler process for them. And so a lot of patients are questioning always, well, what's the difference and is this as accurate? And the bottom line is yes, that it is. It doesn't really matter where we collect it from. The main reason that we use blood here is that there is always the potential with a saliva sample, it gets sent to the laboratory and they get it and there's not enough actually there. The quantity of DNA present is not going to allow them to run the test, in which case we now have to drag the patient back in to do another sample collection. So blood is always a pretty sure thing. The one rare situation with that is that with patients who are actively receiving chemotherapy treatment, it is destroying white blood cells. White blood cells are where your DNA is. And so if they have a low white blood cell count at the time of our collection, there are some times where we will run into an issue there, but it's pretty rare. Skin biopsy is one other thing. So anytime we are seeing patients who have a hematologic malignancy, they potentially and typically have active tumor cells circulating in the blood. And so to collect a blood sample to do genetic testing for germline reasons could be misleading, because what we find may not represent actually their germline. It may represent the tumor that is circulating. And so anytime we're seeing patients who have leukemias, lymphomas, that type of thing, typically we have to do cultured fibroblasts to do their testing. And so that's usually collected through an initial skin biopsy being done. And then the fibroblasts are cultured here on site before we send them to the outside laboratory where the analyses will be completed. With genetic testing, we always have to look at the laboratories and, you know, the tests that we're pursuing, the sensitivity, the specificity of the testing, you know, the different technologies. Not all labs are created equal, and there are more labs out there than ever before offering hereditary cancer testing. And they all do things a little differently. And their platforms can be a little different, which means when we're talking about something as minute as a missense mutation in a single gene that we're looking for, we want to make sure that we're using a lab that's going to give us the most accurate result possible. The other thing I mentioned is that not every patient wants this testing. So more testing is not always better. We can test for lots of things. A lot of times, like I said, when we're doing panel testing, we may be doing anywhere from 15 to 35 genes at a time for a patient looking at hereditary risk. Although we can test for all of these, we don't understand all of them to the same degree. So there are genes that we are testing for these days that we know enough to say mutations here could associate with cancer risk. But risk for what, and how much risk, and how are we going to manage that risk, we may not know right now. And for some patients, they would say, I'm not sure I want that information. You're going to give me a result that says, hey, you're at risk, and then we're going to send you out the door and say, good luck with that. There are some people who that's going to cause a lot of anxiety. They're going to lay asleep at night, awake at night, wondering, what am I doing, and why did I get this test, because I can't do anything differently. And so we very much here at Roswell give our patients an option as to how much testing they pursue. There are other places that kind of take a one-size-fits-all and they give them the biggest panel, and they don't really give that patient the option to choose a smaller approach. But we do, and one of the reasons we do is that we have found that there absolutely are patients who do not want testing on everything. They don't want those ambiguous results. They don't want to be left in that scenario. They'd rather be in a more controlled setting that ensures that if they're tested for something and something is found, it's going to be something we understand, and that they'll be offered some guidelines as to how they can manage those risks. Unless you don't have a TV and you don't watch any social media, everyone knows that there are all kinds of ancestry tests out there, 23andMe, you name it. There's all kinds of direct-to-consumer marketing of genetic testing. So we are actively getting calls all the time of people who had this test and they don't know what it means and what do we do with this information. We hate them from a clinical standpoint. They're not very well regulated. The accuracy is not very well understood or explained to people. And a lot of times they're testing for things that are very vague. And I actually just had a patient's spouse ask me the other day, what did I think about this? Because I think, and I didn't even pointedly ask, are you thinking about spending your money? Go spend your money on something else. But, you know, I said a lot of times these tests are going to look and say, you know, we've found SNPs or different things that suggest you're at higher risk for certain things. But a lot of times what they're telling you are things you already know. You know, yes, you have some markers that suggest you may have higher risk for heart disease. Well, most people know that there might be multiple people in their family who died of heart disease. So it's not something that has really surprised them. And most of the time, the findings that are kind of come back are not going to change their medical care. So from a purely curiosity standpoint, sure, it's interesting. You know, the ancestry of which region did I, you know, my family originate from, it's interesting. But a lot of this direct-to-consumer testing is not going to change or guide medical decision-making at this point. We're just not there yet. So it's one of those things where the technology has very much outpaced our knowledge, and so it's available and it's being marketed to people, and people are spending their money on it, but I don't think that a lot of people fully understand kind of the limitations of what that testing is doing. And really, my bigger question often is, well, if this is a test that was so important to your healthcare, why is your doctor not actually involved in facilitating what's being done here? Real quickly, so genetic test results, as I always explain to people, are not black and white, yes or no, which is also part of the complicated issue of genetic testing is, okay, well, it's not just a blood draw. And then what do we do when we get the information back? How do we understand it? What does it mean, and how does it change anything? And our big thing being is if you don't understand that ahead of time, you shouldn't be ordering the testing if you don't know what you're going to tell your patient. And so one of the big things to know is that, like I said, there are multiple test results that can come back on every gene that we analyze. There's actually 5 different ways that a test result can be classified. And so it's not, yes, we found a mutation, or no, we didn't. There's actually 3 other categories in the middle. And so that very middle one, we call it a variant or a VUS. Those 3 on the left there, you know, whether it's a variant, it's likely benign, or it's benign, we do not use to change medical management. Those are findings, and so that's where a variant is often misunderstood in a clinical setting, is that, yes, we get a test report, it's going to say there was something different. You know, the BRCA2 gene has an alteration in it, but we then need to look and say, well, how are they, what is that classified as? How are they interpreting that result? If it is classified as a variant, it means we do not know. We don't know whether this is affecting the function of the gene, whether this has anything to do with cancer risk, and we certainly are not going to guide medical management based on that finding until we know more about it. One of the big reasons for that is that anytime these variants come up through the clinical laboratories, the labs are going to continue researching this to be able to reclassify it. Our goal, the lab's goal, certainly is not to have things classified as variants. It is not useful information. They will continue to collect data and perform research studies and laboratory work to try to better say, okay, is this variation actually affecting the function of the gene? And whenever variants come up, we do get reclassifications eventually. We just don't ever know how long we may wait for that. So I have patients who have variants identified, and 6 weeks later, I may get an update from the lab. It is sent directly to me. It says amended in the top corner. It's a new report, and it's basically the finding's still the same. That hasn't changed, but here's now what we think it means. I also have patients, I've been here at Roswell for 15 years, I have patients who over 12 years ago we had a variant and we are still waiting for additional information and we are still kind of stuck in this holding pattern. The main thing we know though is that of all variants that have been identified, when they end up being reclassified, the majority of all of them move to the left. They get reclassified as nothing. And so that is the reason why we do not change medical management based on the finding of a variant, is because it would cause people to be pursuing procedures, surgeries, screenings that they may not actually need and that carry their own level of risk. So that is something that is very misunderstood, is because we get a result, there's something there, and so everyone feels, well, if there's something there, we need to do something, and that certainly is not the case. You know, just to the right there, so we do get these classifications that are called a variant likely pathogenic. This is a variant. Essentially, in how they classify, there is actually 5 lines of evidence that have to be achieved when they are classifying a mutation to determine whether it's pathogenic or not. And so these are ones that usually maybe have 3 lines of evidence or 4 lines of evidence, and we're pretty close to saying, yes, this is what is going on. But they can't outrightly call it that way. These are ones that are felt to have enough information suggestive of the impact to risk that we are going to guide medical management differently and use that to impact how the family is being taken care of. I mentioned before about wanting to interpret a result as a negative versus a true negative, and that, you know, getting a test result that doesn't find anything is not always the get out of jail free card. You know, a true negative essentially is there's a family history of cancer, there has been a mutation identified, and now somebody doesn't have that mutation. We know the factor that's causing the cancer, and somebody else in the family doesn't have it. That is the only situation where we would say they're a true negative. Their risk for cancer doesn't go to 0, but they certainly go back to general population risk. more often what we are dealing with is I have a family history, a patient who has a family history of cancer. We do testing. We don't find anything, so their result is negative, but nobody else in the family has ever been tested, which means they still have a family history of cancer. We don't know what's causing it. It may not be something that we can even identify through testing. And in those situations, those people need to still be managed as if they're at higher risk. And so we always say when genetic testing is negative, unless it's a true negative, these people need to look back at, okay, well, what type of cancers have occurred, and their screening and medical care needs to be based on what their family history has been. One of the things that comes up is talking about full disclosure of results. So these variants can be very confusing to patients. They can cause a lot of anxiety because we're saying we found something, but don't lose sleep over it. We're not going to do anything. We're going to treat it as a negative right now. But every now and then, I said, although the majority of them get reclassified as nothing, sometimes they do get upgraded. Sometimes we have a variant that suddenly is reclassified as being a mutation, as being pathogenic. There are some people who feel that we should not be disclosing variants to patients. We're just muddying the waters. We're confusing them and overwhelming them. They don't need to know all of this. Except that what happens when you have done a test on a patient that had a variant, but you didn't tell them. You said everything looks good, and you just sent them on their way. And then a year later, you're calling them saying, so, you remember that test you had? Guess what? It wasn't okay. Now we got something. That makes people quite angry. It is not the best way to practice medicine. And so we certainly feel that patients need to be fully informed of what they're doing, why the testing is being done, and what the true result is. And then our job is to help them kind of process it and really be able to put it in its right place and understand it. But it also helps so that when these odd things do happen, they're going to be a little more prepared for it. They know that there's a variant. They know that it could go either way. And although we've told them most likely it's going to downgrade, that's not always the case. Actually, we just got a variant on a patient. So BRCA testing began around 1996 clinically. And here at Roswell, everywhere for a while, a lot of people did testing without a name. They didn't want their name attached to it. There were no privacy laws. There was no non-discrimination. There was nothing to protect people from their genetic information being used against them. And so a lot of patients would have testing done under a code, under a number. And so we facilitated that here at Roswell in the very beginning. And we just got notified on a patient that was tested, I think, in 1999 through a clinical lab, who had a finding that was classified as a variant that suddenly just got upgraded. And so it is now considered a pathogenic mutation, which is really important information to that patient and their family. So first we had to figure out how to figure out who the patient is, because it's just a code on our result, but we have a key, so we have crossed it. The next thing, unfortunately, was the patient that this testing was done on was an ovarian cancer patient, and so unfortunately she is no longer alive. So now we need to figure out, okay, what legality and right do we have to reach out to her family? Can we even find people in her family? Luckily, because we collect pedigrees, we have names of family members. We know she has children who are now adults that this could be really important for, and so we are currently working through the legal and logistical way of how do we get this information to a family. And this is something that's going to come up more and more, because as we're testing more people than ever, variants, because we're doing big panels, variants are coming up quite often. There are going to be reclassifications, and services need to have a plan in place as to how they're going to facilitate that and notify people as these variants are reclassified. The last thing that we always talk about, and that's really important with testing also, is to talk about what we call cascade testing, which means we find a mutation in somebody, we really want them to engage the rest of their family. This information is really helpful to them, but it's really important to everyone in that family. And our job is to help inform and educate that patient to go out the door to their family. We don't contact their family members. They're not our patients. We don't know them. We have no relationship with them. And so we really try to engage the patients to understand the importance of this. We always tell them, you don't need to educate your family members on every aspect of this mutation and the risks, but rather you just need to let them know it exists and let them decide whether they want to know or not. Every family has people who do not want to know this information, and that's okay. But there absolutely are going to be family members in every family who would want to know if this information was available to them, because it could change how they're caring for themselves. Some of our responsibilities in doing genetic testing, we have to have informed consent. It has to be a written informed consent. That is in New York State law. So we collect written consents and keep them on file for every patient that is tested. Like I said, you need to be prepared to tell a patient what the result means once they have had the testing, and then we, you know, we have a very short-term relationship with patients. We see them for a very intense 90 minutes. We learn everything about their family. We order a test. We get the result. We share it with them, and we tell them, here's what this means. Here's what you need to do, and then we send them back to their doctors. And so we refer patients to high-risk screening clinics, to surgeons, to specialists as needed, and we send them back to their community providers with the information for them to be cared for based on whatever it may be that we found. And then, like I said, we need people referred back. And so I think that, here we go. We always need to be reassessing, and for many reasons. You know, even in a patient who had a test that had a mutation identified, they need to stay in touch with us, because when BRCA was first described, it was breast cancer, and then it was breast and ovarian, and then it was breast, ovarian, and prostate, and now pancreatic cancer is part of the picture, and melanoma is there as well. Things keep changing, and the guidelines to how we would tell a family to be screened or managed may be different from when they got their mutation to what they are now. And so we need to keep them engaged. They need to stay in contact with us. Patients who had genetic testing in the past and was negative, they may be candidates for more testing, even for a single gene. So BRCA testing technology had about 3 massive technology shifts over the course of its life so far. The biggest one happened around 2012, when large rearrangement or deletion duplication analysis became widespread and universally offered to patients having BRCA testing. And so prior to that, sequencing was all that we were doing. We were looking for, you know, missense mutations and single letter changes in the gene, as I explained to my patients. But we know that 6 to 10% of families who have BRCA mutations have a large rearrangement. And so unless we use the right technology to evaluate for it, those families are being missed, and they don't know that they're actually walking around with risk. These are the people that need to be sent back and offered additional testing. And then the guidelines change. The criteria as to who should be offered testing has changed. So there are patients that I saw years ago who I met with, and I said, yeah, you have some history. You don't really meet the current criteria for us to offer you testing, which means I'm probably not going to be able to get your insurance to pay for the testing. They recontact me, and things have changed, and nothing their family's changed. They still have the exact same history, but because the guidelines have changed, we would now offer them testing potentially. And so we always have to keep reassessing that. Real quickly, we pretty much do adult genetics in cancer setting, and the reason for that is the majority of hereditary cancer syndromes are not posing risk to children. And there is a World Health Organization guideline that essentially says we don't do genetic testing on kids if it's not going to change their medical management. And so typically, you know, with all of these things, BRCA, all those different conditions, we're talking about an adult onset cancer risk. And so we won't test anyone until they're at least 18. And really, we even try to push them a little further and let them get a little bit older, because a lot of the screening guidelines don't go in effect till they're in their mid-20s. And so unless we're going to do something differently for them, there's not strong evidence that we need to be doing the testing, and there's actually harms that have been shown in doing it too soon, and how that affects the individual themselves and their relationships. I mentioned about discrimination, privacy issues. This is a big part of it. Long ago, there were not really any laws or statutes in effect to protect people, and so a lot of people avoided genetic testing. They had a lot of concerns about, if I was labeled as having a hereditary risk for cancer, I'm not going to be able to get insurance, and that was an understandable and really a realistic concern. There are laws in place on a federal level at this point to protect against that as it relates to employment and health insurance. So this GINA law essentially indicates that somebody's genetic test result cannot be used against them in decisions about that. There are no protections, though, in other areas like life insurance or disability insurance or short-term care insurance. So those are things, especially when we're working with a younger population who may not have established life insurance policies yet, as 20-some-year-olds, this is something we say, hey, you might want to think about this. You know, if an application asks you, do you have a mutation for hereditary cancer syndrome, you legally are obligated to answer that accurately and truly. Right now, we also know there's a lot of companies who aren't asking that, so I usually say, go find another company and get their application. But this is something that we just want people to know about before they decide to move ahead with their genetic testing. That being said, we've also heard from some of our colleagues across the country that they've had patients come in who were filling out life insurance applications, and as they listed their family history, because that's what a life insurance application is going to ask about, the life insurance company said, ooh, this looks a little fishy, and had told the applicant they have to go have genetic testing and show that it was negative before they will approve their application, which was not something we had thought we would see happen. So they're kind of coming at it backwards from what we expected. But right now they have the right to do that. There are no policies or laws to protect them in that regard. So the bottom line is, as I explained to people, you know, we quote that only 5 to 10% of all cancers have a hereditary or a genetic component to them. So I deal with the very, very small subset of all patients at Roswell. And so, yes, it's rare. And even of all the patients I test, only about 20% of them have a definitive mutation identified. And so, you know, we kind of hardly make a ripple on the patient population here at Roswell. But for the families that are affected by this, this is really, really important to them and can have a really huge impact not only on how somebody is being treated currently, but how they're going to be screened and managed and how their family members are as well. And so it's really important. And their doctors are in a position of liability if they are not accurately identifying patients to be evaluated for a hereditary cancer risk. Oops. Real quickly, just so you kind of have an understanding of how we operate. So the majority of patients that we see here at Roswell are already Roswell patients. The majority of them have already had a cancer diagnosis. They're being referred to us actively out of one of the clinics. A lot of patients we see are breast cancer patients, GYN, colon, prostate is starting to slowly get on board with us. But we do have providers in the community that refer patients to us as well. And patients can self-refer to meet with us based on a family history. We also kind of stratify how quickly they need to be seen. Right now our department actually only has two of us, so there are two genetic counselors here. Last summer there were four of us, so we are in a state of crisis at the moment. In that regard, we currently are scheduling almost 6 months out because we have a high demand and we just don't have enough time to see all of them. When our appointments take 60 to 90 minutes, we can only do a few a day. And so we stratify patients based on the urgency of this information and how it's needed for them. And so the majority of patients are routine. This is not going to immediately change anything for them. This information is not needed to make treatment planning decisions. But if it isn't urgent, and we do see those, so a lot of them are breast patients who've just been diagnosed. They're making surgical planning. They may decide to pursue more extensive breast surgery if there's a mutation. We're going to see them within a week. The time-sensitive patients are typically ones who are going to have surgery, but it's not imminent. So a lot of breast patients may be having chemotherapy before their surgery. And in that case, we have a window of a couple of months. And so we kind of try to stratify what is the patient's situation, how quickly do they need to be put on our schedule so that we can get everybody in the time frame that is needed for them. And so essentially when patients are referred to us, we mail them an appointment offer. It has a very intensive family history questionnaire that we ask them to complete. A lot of them, when I meet with them, go, whoa, that took a lot of time, and I had to call a lot of people, and I go, I know, that's why we sent it to you. We want as much detail as we can because that's going to make our assessment as accurate as possible in terms of what we think is going on. And so that is what they receive ahead of time. And then, like I said, we meet with them. We go through the family history. We provide an assessment. We offer them testing. If they're interested in it, we facilitate it that day. So they are consented. Blood is drawn. Everything is sent to the outside testing laboratory. None of the testing is done on site here at Roswell or in Western New York. Genetic test results usually take about 3 weeks to come back. And so, you know, there's a little lag time, which is why when it is urgent, we need to get them in immediately because results are not going to be back the next day. And then when test results come in, routinely at this point, we offer patients an option of either meeting with us face-to-face to go over the information or that we'll meet or we'll talk with them over the phone and provide it to them. And we leave that to their discretion as to how they want to do that. And then as soon as we get all that information, we do clinic notes that go to their physicians so that they know what the result and outcome was as well. So that's kind of genetics in a nutshell, an introduction of it. I know Dr. Block had said that further in the semester you may be having more specific lectures related to breast cancer genetics or colon cancer genetics. It may be me or my colleague to kind of talk a little more specifics, but this should give you kind of a general overview of how that all then works. So thank you. If you have questions, you can email me.